It's Saturday, June 5th, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, Geek News, and in the second half, we'll be chatting about skepticism and magic. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. The theme today was from Michael Newman. Thank you very much. Pet Star Music. If you'd like to participate by creating a theme for Geek Speak, we'd welcome your participation. You can send us your theme ideas or just a full song. We'll play it on air as long as you, like we, do a Creative Commons license with your content. That means Geek Speak is Creative Commons. You can do anything you'd like with it as long as you attribute us. And let us know if you do. We'd love to know that you're rebroadcasting it or putting it on your podcast, whatever you'd like. I'm Lyle Troxell, and in the air with me are Al Luckow. He's a new media architect. Good morning, Al.
Hello, everybody.
We also have Miles Elam, and Miles Elam is, what are you lately, a slacker?
Pretty much.
All right.
He's too tired to be a slacker.
Yeah, just works too hard?
I need a nap.
And we also have Ben Jaffe. He's a freelance media guy and the author of Command Tab. Hello.
Good morning. I need to update that for Monday.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Command Tab, of course, is a Twitter feed which makes suggestions on how to use your Mac without your mouse.
Keyboard shortcuts.
That's right. Well, we will start. Well, Al will cover a story in just a second about, well, keeping you aloft. That's it. But first, Ben, what's up with space news?
Space news. So Friday, very, very exciting news. SpaceX is a private company which is endeavoring to launch vehicles into space because NASA is kind of not going to be able to do all that much of it, especially with the new plan and budget cuts and everything. And they reached orbit yesterday on their first test flight for their rocket. So that's extremely exciting. It was a 10-minute ascent, and there is a video of it online, which I'll post up on geekspeak.org. And actually, a lot of people were nervous about it because there were hours of delay. Initially, there were telemetry problems on the launch pad. And then there was a sailboat, it kind of went into the restricted area for the launch. So they had to abort all countdown, restart over again. But then the second countdown actually made it all the way. So
does this mean that we officially have a commercial spacecraft?
We have a success. It was a two-stage rocket and everything. So that's all very exciting. But they were launching a dummy version of their mission that they're going to send up. So it's not 100%. It's kind of like saying, oh, well, it worked this once. We'll just hope that they can do it again and again, reliably and safely.
They leave something floating up there? I mean, don't they have like a little satellite in low orbit or something for a year? I heard they put something in low orbit and it's going to burn up after a year or something.
Yeah, I'm actually not familiar with that. They probably did.
You know who the guy is behind that company, right?
Elon Musk, right?
He's the co-founder of Tesla, co-founder of PayPal. I mean,
yeah,
he's interesting guys. Like,
a lot of ideas and a lot of money.
If he comes to you with a startup idea, you say yes.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. It seems like
you'd like, sir.
He's a startup guy, that's for sure.
It seems like he just decided, you know what, I think I'm going to try and go to space.
Yeah.
Just like in his bedroom one night, he was like laying in bed.
What is there left for me to do?
Yeah, go to space. What's next? I don't know.
All right, well, more down to earth, Miles?
Yes. BMW and Audi.
British motor
German automakers.
Bavarian Motorworks.
Thank you very much.
And I don't know what BMW stands for.
He just said.
It was?
Bavarian Motorworks, yeah.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
It's not Bavarian Motorwerks?
No, I think you're right. It is Bavarian Motorwerks.
Okay. So
and Audi. Sorry.
It's my horrible German accent.
I think that's wrong. It's Bayerisch Motorenwerken AG.
I think Al was funnier. Go on.
So, yeah, you're right. Bavarian Motorwerks.
We tend to think in terms of fuel economy for hybrid cars or electric cars or, for example, recently with the presidential election, the idea of keeping your tires properly inflated to keep up fuel economy. Well, in the town or city of Ingolstadt in Germany, they're working at making the lights timed in such a way that it encourages people to drive an optimum speed and to keep them moving. And you know, so if they're speeding, they have to slow down anyway. So for people to time the lights, so they're going the right
speed. I thought lights right always speed. Worked that way.
Have you driven around in Santa Cruz?
Yeah. If you drive on Mission Street and drive about the speed limit, once you get a green light, you'll then get green lights.
You've driven the speed limit on Mission Street?
Yeah, you're pretty much in traffic. You have to.
You can't even get to the speed limit on Mission Street. It's like,
but what they have found is
it gets messed up with a pedestrian.
Right. But yeah. By checking this out, by trying to optimize mm-hmm. the light schemes in this city, they've reduced overall fuel consumption by 17%.
How do they know that? Oh, because the amount of fuel is being purchased.
That's a fine question.
I guess if they have enough data on how the cars are traveling, they know how much less they're doing idle and how much less they're doing startup and such. So you can
they had a group of test vehicles go through there. Okay.
Gotcha. Okay,
had
cool.
adaptive
cool.
cruise control system, sense. Maintain an optimum speed.
They did a study. Cool. I like. All right, so is that going to happen everywhere? And that's just changing signals.
No, because there are a lot of cities that are making their yellow lights less than 2 seconds in violation of the law just so they can get people for, you know, tickets.
Because, of course, local government has no responsibility to make things better for fuel economy.
Right.
That's not their concern necessarily.
Especially if people don't actually pay attention to the local politics. And
right. I like the idea of making cars not do the things that are fuel consumptive. Is that the correct term?
Sure.
It makes a lot of sense. Thanks. Al?
Yes.
Aloft? Keeping you aloft?
Right. Well, if you're like me, you probably read comic books when you were a kid. I always like reading comic books, and even as an adult, I see them as a way to get kids interested in reading. In many ways, I was influenced by comic books. A lot of the things I think about today started back then, but I'm not talking about the superheroes or Sergeant Rock or Batman or anything like that. I'm talking about the ads. Now, this might not make sense to you, depending on when you grew up. What I remember as a kid was seeing ads for selling grit, earning prizes, building a body the size of Charles Atlas and kicking sand in bullies' faces, ways to earn money selling seeds door-to-door, sea monkeys, you know, et cetera.
Sea monkeys, definitely.
I mean, if these things sound familiar to you, then you can relate to what I'm about to bring up. The one ad that I could never get out of my head, not including X-ray glasses, was the one where you could buy the plans to build a hovercraft. I used to just sit there and dream about this. I never sent away for it, but I sure got a lot of enjoyment dreaming about how something as cool as this could exist. Well, here I am decades later, and I found one on the web. Somebody actually built one of these things, and it looks like the exact one I remember. And he has a video of it, of his son riding it. And ultimately, as a kid, in my mind, I sort of omitted the electrical cord. So when I saw the video, it's sort of a downer. But it was cool nonetheless. I went on a quest, though, and found another hovercraft kit made for adults that looks like the vehicle of my dreams. You can fly it like 10 feet over the water. It also hovers over land. There's a variety of kits you can get. And when you consider this as a vehicle, they're surprisingly affordable. It's powered by a 4-cylinder automotive engine. It's called the UH-18SP.
Serious vehicle if it's got a car engine in it.
Well, 4-cylinder. Yeah, well, it's a small car engine, but yeah.
Yeah.
And it's pretty much everything that you could imagine. I mean, they have video of this thing flying around.
Ten feet above the ground, above the water.
Of the water, yeah. I mean, that's what they say, and I saw a video, and it looked like about 10 feet. I imagine you could go 10 feet above the ground, yeah. But, you know, it's a kit. And if you built a kit.
10 feet seems like a pretty severe amount of air pressure. I mean, the way a hovercraft.
Well, it's got, like, short wings. They're like 4 feet on each side, mm-hmm. not even, and they're real squarish, so it's enough to give you that kind of lift, and they pop right off when you want to move the thing. So apparently you can bring this thing anywhere you want. It shows people driving them. I think it probably could go 10 feet above the ground, but you know, if it's a kit and you built it and you're going to fly something 10 feet over the ground, maybe you want to do it over water.
So a hovercraft, I mean, how it works is there's a skirt of cloth around the base, normally something flexible, mm-hmm. and you put a bunch of, you fill that plenum with air, and the air has to escape because it's being blown in really quickly from the top,
right.
and that lifts the vehicle off. But normally that flow of air isn't very high. But what you're saying, if it has wings, what most likely is you have very low friction. So you can throw it on a flat plane of water. Mm-hmm. And maybe you're 6 inches above the water, and then it sounds like they propel it really fast with wings. So you start to kind of actually fly.
Yeah, the wings
with
are
a soft
like,
landing.
They're like square. Yeah. They don't look like wings sticking out. They're
more like stabilization.
They're more like big fins on the side, and it lifts it up.
Interesting.
I mean, I've never been in a hovercraft, but when I look at these, it's the one I dreamed about as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
It's worth checking out, going looking at these videos and seeing them. I mean, if you remember this like I do, I mean,
that's cool. Yeah. I do remember the ads on the back. The sea monkeys were always the fun.
I mean,
ones.
You know, you read all these comic books, but it's the ads. You know, all these things that were in there.
I mean, come on, X-ray
like,
specs.
All this stuff. You know, could those X-ray specs really work?
I mean, the flying car that you could buy the plans for $299.
Yeah.
I don't know if that one worked. In a second, Miles is going to talk about AT&T, and we're also going to talk about a website that gives the new meaning to negative space. But first, Ben, beer?
Beer, yeah. Of all of the geeks, I would be the one covering a story on beer. That's just silly.
Yeah, you're not even old enough to drink beer.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Okay.
Well, wait, you're old enough to drink beer. You're just not old enough to enjoy beer.
He hasn't acquired the taste yet.
Ooh. Well, okay. So most of the world's beer has between 4% and 6% alcohol by volume. But there is this technique called freeze distillation, where you can achieve higher qualities and more alcohol by volume of the beer. So there's been this kind of escalation in this competition to get the highest alcohol by volume. 12 months ago, the highest was 27%. But now we're up in the range of 40-some%.
Wow.
Yeah, there's beer that's the same proof as vodka out there.
Yeah, they're
it's not beer.
On the contrary, it is.
It is, because it's done the same way. It's still fermenting.
I believe it's called Tactical Nuclear Penguin. Not kidding. That's the name of the beer.
Yeah, I'm looking at this list of beers. There's in 2007 there was Samuel Adams Utopias, which is 27%. But now, like going in from probably pretty much about mid 2009 to now, we've got a whole bunch of beers. Half of them I can't pronounce, so I'm not going to try. But 31%, 32%, 40%, 41%, 43%. So it looks like we're kind of in a competition to get to 50%. Who knows who will get there first? But this is like,
and this is a pretty geeky endeavor because it's not like traditional brewing and fermenting, right?
No. This is freeze distillation. So roughly the way it works is that you take this solution of beer and you start to freeze it. You bring down the temperature, and then you remove the parts that freeze first. To kind of get some sort of purification. And it's not quite that simple. There are a lot more...
The thing that's interesting, I mean, if you're just removing the water out of the beer, if you will, I mean, the fermenting process, I'm going to assume the alcohol content is a certain level because the alcohol is actually a side effect of the yeast eating. And so if you had too much yeast or too much alcohol, the yeast wouldn't do its thing anymore. It would die. That's what I'm assuming that alcohol... Beer has always traditionally been a certain volume of alcohol. Or percentage of alcohol. And so now what you're doing is you're basically messing with it after the fact. But didn't it sound like to you they were kept on fermenting? They do a flash freeze and then ferment again?
I'm actually not sure. I mean, I kind of wish I knew a little more about beer, covering a beer story. I figured you guys would know.
Well, yeah, Al, don't you?
Yeah, I make beer.
Yeah.
But, my beer doesn't approach that kind of... alcoholic volume.
Why would you want to drink that kind of beer?
Well, I don't know.
I guess it would taste good.
I mean,
and
maybe
it would be very alcoholic.
Maybe. I mean,
like if you really liked beer and you wanted to have like a hard drink, that would be a perfect thing. But
yeah, there's the novelty of it. Maybe it still tastes like beer. Maybe it still tastes good. I'm sure it still tastes like beer, but maybe it still actually tastes good.
Yeah.
So I mean, if you can get something that's 43% and you can get a bottle, you can share it among many people. And
all right, thank you for the beer update. I appreciate that.
Certainly,
Miles. What's going on with AT&T?
AT&T is going to be changing their data plan pretty soon.
I got a note about this.
Yeah, it's going to coincide with Apple's announcements of new products on the 14th of this month, June 14th. which is a Tuesday, I believe, as it always is. And the change is going to be, instead of having an iPhone having unlimited data or the iPad with 3G with unlimited data, they're changing the plan so that there is no more unlimited data plan. The lower end is a 200 megabyte per month plan, and then a upgraded version of that, which is 2 gigabytes per month.
They're not doing unlimited.
They're not doing unlimited.
Huh.
And the idea is that if you download 4 gigabytes, for every gigabyte that goes over that 2 gigabyte limit, mm-hmm. it's $10. So,
okay.
4 gigabytes would add up.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's still within some range.
I mean, if you're on the 3G network on an iPad and watching, you know, YouTube videos all day, you'd go through that. You'd go through some money.
Mm-hmm. If you're on the 3G network as opposed to someplace where there's Wi-Fi.
Right.
A lot of folks are also, like myself, I use Pandora and YouTube at home, mm-hmm. viewing stuff at home. So I do a lot of stuff where I don't even think about it. I'm not doing it on the 3G network.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not overall when you're using your device. This is only when you're out and about.
Have you looked at your iPhone usage to see what kind of usage you've been doing?
For the data, I haven't, because I haven't had to. One of the things that AT&T has stated, though, is that they're going to be telling people when they're approaching the limit.
Oh, good.
When they're at 60% of the limit, 90% of the limit, you know, that type of thing. And then if you go into an overage, it'll let you know if you're getting close to the end of that first overage and going into a second one. So that's good to know. But it's something you need to keep in mind, that if you get that message, if you're about to go over, you need to go into...
Change your habit.
Well, you need to go into the settings and say, oh, okay, I need to turn off my 3G and Edge, so I just have it as a phone, and I can't do any data until you get home to go on Wi-Fi.
Right.
So it'll be a little bit more difficult. There are some people that are a little upset about this. One particular person, Free Press Policy Counsel, M. Chris Riley, was saying that today's heavy user is tomorrow's average user, which has always been true. As people start moving to the era of watching TV, you know, watching movies on the go, it's definitely going to be more and more the case. So as we look around the world and see the different pricing schemes that are available, the U.S. is falling behind.
Of course. Thank you very much. That's kind of a sad theme, actually. But thank you very much.
And up on the website, I'll be putting up an infographic that shows you about how many songs you can stream from Pandora, you know, per month, or
kind of give you an
play
idea
games
of how much
strategy.
Is too, yeah.
That's not based on this is how many megabytes, how many gigabytes, but units that you'll be more attuned to.
Right. Good. I like that. Because, yeah, 200 megabytes versus 2 gigabytes, us in the room know, but nobody else really necessarily knows what that is.
Right.
All right. Thank you very much for that. Al, I mean, coming in just a second, we're going to talk about human-animal hybrids. Mm-hmm. But first, Al, what about negative space?
I found this website, and it's called, I don't know how to really say it, it's GUIMP. It's GUIMP.com. And it claims to be the world's smallest website at 18 pixels by 18 pixels. And you might look at, you know, you hear this and you'd say, that's weird. How can a website be so small? And actually, by the way, I actually found one a little bit smaller. It's 16 by 16 pixels. It's like, but this GUIMP one is way better. And you can do things like, I don't know if you can imagine this because it's radio and you're like, what are you talking about? You can't even see that. Well, it has a Pac-Man game in there. It's got Breakout. It's got Pong, Asteroids. It's got a gallery of pixel art.
Mm-hmm. Go on.
All different kinds of stuff that is in this tiny, tiny 18 by 18 pixel page. And until you've actually tried it, you really can't understand how this thing is a really cool thing. I think after the show last week, I pulled it up and everybody was just like, yeah, right. You know, and before I knew it, every person in this room was like
it was
goofing
a cool
around
website.
With it.
Really is neat.
It's really a neat thing.
You can navigate the whole thing in this very small amount of
area. It's like, I guess you can do it that small, you know. And it's worth checking out. I put both links to the other one's called .16.
Yeah, but I like the one that's...
And the one we have, the first one, it's a little bit bigger, but it's got games. The other one's kind of more of a promotional thing for a company that does, like, pixel art and stuff.
All right.
But it's totally worth checking out. I mean, you won't believe it.
All right, in just a minute, Miles is going to wrap up our news section of today's show with some talk about living in denial. But in any case, first, animal-human hybrids?
Ben? So I just put this in the news thing. It's a mention. But I found it really strange headline. Ohio Senate passes bill banning human-animal hybrids. So apparently the Ohio Senate, the article makes quite a funny joke, which is the sci-fi movie Splice seems to have scared the Ohio State Senator Steve Bauer or whatever. So yeah, they have passed a bill that bans human cloning and the use of human-animal hybrids in Ohio.
And you think this is like, oh, well, that makes sense, until you talk to biologists and you start realizing that actually this could be restrictive.
Yeah, just to be clear, that movie Splice, complete nonsense.
I think the term is garbage.
I liked it.
Oh, okay. I didn't see it.
It doesn't even rank as garbage.
Yeah. Right. So what's the problem with, I mean, why do they not like the idea of splicing humans and animals?
I think it just really
just creeps people out.
Creeps them out. Like, so the senator said, quote, "I would hope there's one area, no matter where you fall on the continuum of life and research and other things, that you would agree that the mixing of humans and animals in a scientific laboratory is not something that's appropriate." So I think perhaps he's thinking of the movie Splice, right, or something, as opposed
to... We're not talking about humans with teddy bear ears and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, most... which, come on, that'd be cool. Yeah. Is... Because you're cuter. But... too late for moms. No, but you're more talking about humans being able to, you know, do what seals can do and breathe the carbon monoxide. I mean, that's cool. Carbon monoxide scrubbers in their lungs. It's perfect. No, what we're really talking about is...
Carbon monoxide or carbon dioxide?
Carbon dioxide, thank you. this car smells delicious. so it takes care of the air pollution problem from cars. No, so the issue would be, I'm trying to think of a sample of a reason why you'd want to be able to do this, but human cloning, there's great examples of this where you can get rid of the mitochondria DNA that might have problems with it, right? So you could actually splice the mitochondria of the father, which actually doesn't happen in normal reproduction, right? The cell itself is made by the mother, therefore the mitochondria comes from the egg cell. So you could theoretically take that little part out, put the father's mitochondria DNA in, and get rid of a whole bunch of genetic issues. But that's kind of cloning because you're kind of making the cell, if you will.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely genetic engineering.
Definitely genetic engineering on humans. So there's that kind of samples where you think at first, well, it's scary to do human splicing and human DNA, you know, manipulating the human genome. And then you look at something simple like, well, here's just another way to reproduce where the egg technically comes from
the father. But what happens if one of these humans that's been spliced gets out and starts reproducing itself?
I guess the
thing that's the problem.
And then they start making beer that's at 60% alcohol level. I mean, God, the world would fall apart.
Well, right. We already know from Monsanto that we can make living organisms that can't breed.
No, Monsanto.
All the seeds that aren't viable.
Yeah.
Right, that's the
So we got
the
that part covered.
Monsanto probably has cloned humans already. And
they're growing in a field in Iowa.
Really, they cloned humans?
So, Miles, part of... Thank you, Ben, for that.
I just wanted to mention that it's the thing that I have a problem with is not so much the, I guess, what they're thinking of when they pass this bill, but the wording seems a little bit ambiguous. They say the creation, transportation, or receipt of a human-animal hybrid. So what does that mean? A full living creature, an organ, you know, like what exactly is the line there? So with legislation like this that's not made by scientists, it's hard to define those things. So anyway.
All right. Thank you very much. We're going to have DJ Growth on. He is the president of the James Roundy Educational Foundation in just a second. But I want to let Miles do a science story. But before all of that can happen, I've got to let you know. Right now, the Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics. Offer an extensive selection of computer electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, we have Miles Elam.
Hey, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Luck out, and Ben Jaffe. You still here, you guys?
Huh?
Oh,
what?
Good.
I was asleep.
Good to hear. And you're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. Does anybody have a geek bit this week? A quick podcast, and
I had a little camera that I thought was kind of cool.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's a little RC camera that I ran across that goes in your, but people put it in their RC planes. It looks like it's about double the size of a thing of chapstick, or maybe the same size as a mace container, and you stick it in your RC plane, and you can fly the plane around, and this thing will take video and store it on like a little drive, a little USB drive in there, and then you can watch it later. And also, you have the ability to kind of control the way the camera moves, you know, what you're looking at. And if you look at the website where, which of course this link will be posted on geekspeak.org after the show, they show videos of a guy who put this in his plane, and his little RC plane, took it off, you know, remote controlled, and he's flying it, and there's like seagulls flying around his plane, and he like looks over at them from his plane, and it's like you're in a plane and you're like looking at the seagulls. This is, you know, and this is like a amazingly cheap little doohickey. So
little aerial little USB. Those are called lipstick cameras. That size is called lipstick.
Yeah, it'll be up on geekspeak.org, so be sure to check the links after the show.
As well, everything we talk on GeekSpeak is on geekspeak.org. DJ Grothy is president of the James Randi Educational Foundation. He has lectured widely on topics at the university, at the intersection, of education, science, and belief at universities such as Stanford, Harvard, Yale, UCLA, UC Berkeley, and dozens of others. Formerly a professional magician, he has special interest in the psychology of belief and process of deception and self-deception. He hosts a radio show and podcast, For Good Reason, which will also be linked up on our radio on our show. That's another geek bit, For Good Reason podcast of DJ Grothy. DJ, thank you so much for being on GeekSpeak today.
Well, thanks, guys. Pleasure to be here.
So, DJ, I want to start by saying, well, first off, there's an amazing meeting happening. It's been happening for about 9 years, I think, and this is a meeting that, of course, James Randi started. Can you describe it? I've never been.
Right. It's this big conference that the James Randi Educational Foundation puts on every year in Las Vegas. It's really our major outreach event. It's the way that we advance our mission of critical thinking about supernatural claims, the paranormal, well, to a growing public. This year, we think we'll have over 1,000 people.
That's
at
big.
Event in July. Yeah, big thing. Lots of leading thinkers, lots of celebrities, interesting people headline at our conferences. Last year, we started internationally doing amazing meetings. We call them TAMs. So in London, we're doing that again this year, also in Australia for the first time this year. But the one you're talking about in Vegas, this year we have like Richard Dawkins, the biologist, the public intellectual, he's headlining. Magicians, Penn and Teller, of course. You mentioned James Randi. Of course, he'll be there. We have people like Adam Savage from the Mythbusters come every year. He's a crowd favorite. So we're hearing that this is really, you know, folks are telling us they think this is the best lineup we've ever had. So we are really excited. That's July 8th through 11th, and it's near to being sold out. People can get more information, of course, at randi.org. That's Randi with an I.
And we'll link of that .org. We'll link that over from geekspeak.org. DJ, when you just described all that, it sounded like a fascinating, fun meeting. It sounded like something I'd love to go to and bring other people. It sounds like a good lineup of entertainers and thinkers. And at the same time, this kind of there's a discussion about the skepticism movement, which this fits under completely. And that, to me, feels really standoffish in some ways. Why is it that this idea of being a skeptic is so restrictive or closed in some sense, when it sounds like the stuff that you talk about is fascinating?
I think there are a couple things going on there. One, the issues that organize skepticism, if you want to think about it for some reason as a movement, the issues that skepticism deals with, well, they are issues that hit people where they live and breathe. They're controversial issues. You know, can we talk to deceased loved ones? Can minds be disembodied and, you know, astral project or communicate with other minds? Or are there UFOs or ghosts? Or, you know, these are issues that some people think are trivial, but in fact I think are very important and strike to the heart of the central beliefs, of society. So skeptics start at the place where they're talking critically about stuff most people believe in. So that kind of from the very start of it sets up a dynamic, I think, sometimes where believers or the credulous think, oh, you skeptics are over there and only all about putting me down for believing what I believe in.
DJ, this leads really well into a news story that Miles has about
denialism. We're talking about skepticism, which I'm sure you would take on as saying, oh, sure, you have asserted something. What's the proof? Give me some evidence for that. which is
the kind of skepticism we're about. It's not denying other people's beliefs, but it's kind of in an open-minded way finding things out. And we could talk more about our kind of skepticism and why other folks might feel skeptics are standoffish as the conversation.
Well, let's talk about
an article. Yeah.
Right, and it is very much about that positive thing, and it also is tying in very well to science and the scientific method, as opposed mm-hmm. to denialism. That notion of the swine flu pandemic was a hoax, or the World Health Organization made it so the big pharma could make money, or mm-hmm. that vaccines are going to cause autism, that they actually ignore the science and try to find and are basically doomers.
Or another good example is the World Trade Towers being taken down by terrorists taking control of airplanes, and that being the entire story.
But the things you guys just mentioned really begin as faith claims. Where people start out with the belief and then deny evidence. We call them denialists for that reason. They deny evidence and only select the evidence that supports their preconceived view. That is in no sense the kind of skepticism I'm talking about. The skepticism the James Randi Educational Foundation pushes out there is, I think, a really affirmative, a kind of a positive way of looking at the world. It's not going around denying people's beliefs. It's really, I think, actually the best way to find things out. And you mentioned science, maybe the methods of science. In that way, skepticism is continuous with the methods of science.
Okay.
Scientists don't start out saying, I don't believe anything. Instead, they say, I only believe those things for which there is good evidence.
Okay. So, of course, I'm thinking from the audience perspective, then skeptics and scientists are always denying a whole bunch of experiences that people have, and they say, well, yeah, but I had this experience, and that's evidence because I had that experience, and therefore you're denying all this evidence, so you're saying that you're not, but you are. And I feel that going all across the crowd. So let's, before addressing that, and just listen really carefully if you have that perspective on our conversation right now, can you tell me, DJ, why does magic work? Like, I'm talking about stage magic.
Actually, this goes right into the previous question you asked, personal experience, right? Personal experience is a kind of evidence, but it's not very good evidence. So I can, as a magician, give someone the personal experience of reading his or her mind or
making something disappear.
You know, making something disappear or causing some occult event, you know, something that seems like real magic. But even though the audience member experienced something that seems like magic, we know that there are these things called magic tricks that magicians spend years learning, and even though you have the experience of the magic, we know that that the experience is not evidence sufficient to warrant the hard belief that the stuff is real.
Okay, so why is that? I mean, I'm pretty good at sleight of hand, right? So I can make a small object disappear in my hands pretty easily, and when I do it for some people, they go, "Oh, that's cool," and other a lot of geeks go, how are you doing that? And I'll maybe show it to them, depends, because I'm not a professional magician. But some people have a scary, almost, mm-hmm. I would say, almost religious experience when that happens. They will freak out with it because they're not expecting that to happen. And therefore, they start thinking something occult, something supernatural is occurring.
I've done mind reading shows earlier on when I was a young man. I'm not too old now, but, you know, late teens, early 20s, where I told people, look, I'm a magician, I'm an entertainer, let's, for 45 minutes, let's pretend this stuff is real, and I'd do a show. People would, sometimes someone would come up afterwards and not have heard any of my disclaimers and ask me for personal advice, using my gifts to direct them and as regards certain issues in their life. In other words, they believed that I had real power.
Right.
Your question, why the difference? Why do some people believe and some people don't believe? Well, in fact, I think we all do believe. We're all predisposed to believe. We're kind of hardwired. And the person who doesn't automatically believe, I think, is an aberration. You know, our brains are, you know, our big craniums are hardwired to connect the dots and see connections, see unseen forces, or at least imagine unseen forces, because there was an evolutionary advantage to connecting the dots. Now, it just so happens that we often connect dots that aren't there, and that's where our skepticism comes in. Our skepticism is actually a tool to offset our natural predisposition to believe things for which there's no good evidence.
Right, and that's actually a point behind the scientific method, is that we have this bias, this pattern recognition bias in our brains. So how do we take that, how do we offset that as
much
as possible?
How do we protect ourselves from it?
And that's actually what the scientific method is.
Yeah. So, I mean, another example of this, magic is a good example of that. But another example, which I love because it takes no training at all, is visual optical illusions, you know, printed illusions where you start seeing that your brain messes with you. You know, two images of a leaning tower next to each other, the exact same image. It looks like the image that is leaning towards the other image is leaning more. And that's just because we have three-dimensional sight, and when we stand next to two tall things next to each other, we see them getting closer as they go off in the distance, but in reality, we know they're parallel. So our brain says, that's parallel. But when you put it on a two-dimensional image, and you just lean them a little bit, and you get two lines that are doing that, if it looks three-dimensional to our brain says, those aren't parallel, and those are doing different things. That's an example of our brain being hardwired to do a certain thing.
Exactly. It shows that we can't trust our senses. Our experience is... you know, it's a kind of evidence. So I don't want to discount personal experience as a kind of evidence, but I also want to be smart enough to realize that my experience is not often the best evidence. Instead, I want to set things up so my experience doesn't deceive me because of these kind of mental hiccups that we acquired through the messy process of evolution.
Mm-hmm. Miles, do you want to do that news story about denialism?
Well, we already pretty much covered it with the topic.
He's denying. He will not do it.
One thing, though, that is interesting about denialism is the fact that often a track that people will take is to say, well, that area is off limits to science. That an area that, well, science can't explain certain things, which is a true statement. Science can't explain certain things. But then they extend it off to be their particular pet project to say, and because science can't explain this one area, then I'm going to generously sprinkle my anti-science pixie dust into other areas, especially things that matter most to me.
Right. What especially is going on there is where people say, well, we lack knowledge about this set of experiences. Science doesn't have it all figured out. Therefore, I have knowledge as to what's really going on, and it's some occult or magical or supernatural explanation. So it's basically people saying, I don't know how that happens, therefore I know how that happens, and it's magic. Science, I think the beauty in science is that it doesn't need to know everything. It says, science is a method as much as it is a body of knowledge, right? A body of facts that we accumulate over time and change in the light of new evidence. It's just also a method, a way of finding things out. And in that way, it's continuous with skepticism. I mentioned this before. In fact, the kind of skepticism I'm talking about is not saying no to other people's beliefs. If someone out there has a psychic power, man, I want to know about it. We offer $1 million prize to anyone who can prove under mutually agreed upon scientific conditions that some paranormal claim or ability is real. We're putting our $1 million on the table for anyone who can prove it. Why? Because we want, you know, if it's real, we want to prove it. Not only because, you know, there's a Nobel Prize in it, if we could prove somehow something that no scientist has been able to prove about the supernatural or the paranormal thus far, but because we want to be right. Not in some arrogant way, but, you know, if I'm wrong, I want someone to show me so I can be right. I generally favor having an accurate view of the universe. And it just so happens after, you know, 40, 50 years of serious research into these fields, there's been no compelling evidence to support any of these kinds of claims. And I'm talking about everything from ufology, you know, whether UFOs are abducting people, ghosts, past life regression, faith healing, complementary and alternative medicine.
A lot of things, a lot of research going on. Right. Miles, you want to say?
Right. I had a couple of points on that, but I remembering reading a Carl Sagan book about this, talking about UFOs, and the propensity for people to say, Science has no idea, or the authorities at large have no idea what this particular blob is that's on there. So it must be UFOs. But
exactly.
They're saying, I don't know what that is, therefore I know what it is.
I think the wonderful thing, of course, is that the term you're using, a UFO, is a perfect term to use.
Unidentified flying object.
Yes.
To say
yes.
that it's
right.
aliens means it's not unidentified.
Right.
It's an identified flying object belonging to aliens.
An alien flying object.
Someone recently asked me, look, even Jimmy Carter saw a UFO. And I said, he absolutely did. I have no reason to doubt that he saw a UFO. He saw something that was unidentified. But Jimmy Carter did, even as great president or not, whatever your political leanings, even as a president, he did what a lot of people do, which is say, that's unidentified. Therefore, I'm identifying it as an alien spacecraft.
So really, it's IFOs that you should be scared of.
Or SIFOs.
Yeah.
Self-identified
flying objects. Yeah, right. Something that is worrisome with regard to the James Randi prize, that million-dollar prize, is the fact that when you were mentioning under proper scientific conditions, that there are so many people that not only don't use a double-blind study, but don't know what it is and don't know why it would be even useful.
Well, the term science is one of those just crazy words bandied about in our society. Sometimes it's the highest compliment you could pay something to call it scientific. And so you even have cults or, let's say, religious movements called Scientology or Christian Science, because science has a cachet. On the other hand, science is scary, and you have images in pop culture of the mad scientist is going to doom us, and a lot of people are afraid of science. Science gives us all this good stuff, but then science, maybe they connect the dots and they think science leads to things like the atomic bomb or the science and technology of oil drilling to the big BP spill.
Right.
And so there's an ambivalent relationship the public has with science. It's our job not to go around and convert everybody to seeing science in the ways that we see it, even as skeptics, and sometimes we're skeptical of the institutions of science because even scientists have their biases. Instead, it's our job to look at these interesting claims that cut to the core of the central beliefs of society and see if there's any evidence to support them.
Right. Cuts to the core of the beliefs, not necessarily because we want to tear them down, but just to check to see if they are, in fact, correct. That's a big distinction there, to say that skepticism is not saying we want to tear everything down, that it is just let's just make sure that we're on the right track.
And here's
something like cynicism. Sorry to cut you off there, but there are skeptics. Look, skepticism has a bad rap sometimes among some credulous, because there are some of the credulous, the believers out there, because there are some skeptics who aren't the kind of skeptic I'm talking about. They are kind of, I call them knee-jerks, right? They're knee-jerk skeptics who just say to every odd belief, oh, there's no such thing. There's no such thing as ghosts, so why are we even looking into it? There's no such thing as psychic powers.
So then what you're really saying then is that you're skeptical of them being skeptics.
Yes, in fact, I'm calling them cynics, not skeptics, right? Because skeptics...
Well, who are you to say this? I mean, who are you afterwards? Do you have any proof that you are who you say you are? Where's your birth certificate?
I don't really think he is a skeptic.
Okay, so boys, we could quickly fall into a glorious kind of solipsism, and that's a radical kind of skepticism that says, wow, science is just one mythic narrative like any other, and there's no difference between science and religion. But, of course, there is. Science is self-correcting. Science changes in light of new evidence. Science doesn't care when it's operating at its best who's right and who's wrong. It just cares that there's a steady progression of where the best ideas rise to the top.
Mm-hmm.
So it ideally doesn't appeal to authority.
There's another thing that's, and there's a side effect. I had an argument with a friend. First off, let me just say that we're talking to DJ Grothy. He is the president of the James Randi Educational Foundation. He's on the show today to talk about the upcoming event TAM, the amazing meeting which is happening in Vegas next month. And We also have Ben Jaffe, Al Luckow, and Miles Elam. My name is Lyle Troxell. JD, DJ, I had a conversation with a friend where he was very, like, I brought up the $1 million prize, the James Randi Educational Foundation prize, and he's like, well, yeah, but they always make you do all these things that complicate things so it doesn't work. They always set it in their favor. And I said, well, they're not saying in their favor. They're putting the scientific method in play. They're saying, let's figure out how to make sure that we can prove with this test that something amazing or something something supernatural is happening, something we don't understand yet is happening. And he's like, yeah, but that's not fair. I said, well, okay. So we got into this dialogue, and what the crux of it was, I was trying to say, look, the best way that we can all come to consensus about what's happening on the planet is using the scientific method. Once you get out of that, it becomes to a belief point, and my point is as valid as yours. There's no way to know who is truthful, whose reality is more accurate, if you will. So let's try to make decisions about the physical world in such a way that we don't play in that field. We play in this field that we can agree on. And that's why I kept on going back to the scientific method, which seemed to kind of work for him.
The claims that are objective, that you could replicate, that it doesn't matter who you are, if the claim is real, another person should be able to duplicate it. So this isn't just about the paranormal, but this is also fringe science stuff like cold fusion. Everyone was excited years ago when scientists made a claim that they could solve the world's energy problems through cold fusion, but it just so happened that no other scientists could duplicate the same research and get the same results. And so, you know, that's what we do in science. I say we, but I'm not a scientist. I'm an advocate, a booster for science. But in science, you throw out ideas that don't pan out, and that's what skepticism ends up doing. But let me be very clear, that's not what we start out wanting to do. We start out just wanting to find things out, look at the best evidence, let the best ideas win, even if those ideas touch on some of our preconceived views. So if a psychic comes to me and shows under mutually agreed upon test conditions that she or he has a paranormal ability, I will change my mind. I will leave the JREF, and I'll be the biggest booster for said psychic. But it just so happens that even scientists can be, bamboozled by magicians. And so you have, in the history of science, you have even leading scientists pushing paranormal views because they think, since I'm a scientist, I am beyond being fooled by a magician. And that kind of arrogance, it juts up against the ideals of science where you kind of guard against your own cognitive biases. And so you have someone like Uri Geller in the 70s had a bunch of real bona fide scientists saying this guy's legit. But it took a man like James Randi to say, hold on, you scientists. He's doing magic tricks. Right. I can duplicate
another magician, right.
Yeah, another magician. Because scientists, many scientists are even more susceptible to being deceived by magic because, you know, it's the smart person that is the, let's say, the target for the magician. It's really hard to fool a four-year-old. But if you're, a three-year-old, if you're a scientist who is used to following the rules and connecting the dots and looking at evidence and believing your senses and all of that sort of stuff, then magicians, I think, you're a little more susceptible to magicians pulling the wool over your eyes.
Yeah, something I always did find interesting, just as a final point, was when people say, oh, my God, that mad scientist is going to make a death ray that's going to kill us all. No one ever asks, like, well, what are your control conditions? What are you comparing against? Where's your data set? And it's like, wouldn't it be interesting if we'd stopped calling them mad scientists and started calling them mad engineers instead?
right.
Because it changes the way people think about science.
Yeah.
Especially in the movies, you know, none of those guys are mad scientists. They're, by definition, engineers, right?
Yeah.
They're not scientists in the lab doing controlled experiments. Instead, they're embarking on big projects to advance a kind of a mission or a cause, and that's what engineers do.
DJ, let me change the theme for just a second and talk about, you earlier said the beauty of science is, and kind of talked about it. And I want to get back to this idea that people have where if you science has this very dry, clinical, you know, non-human way about it. I don't think necessarily geeks feel that way. I think we kind of feel that emotional drive about scientific study and new knowledge. But I think a lot of people feel like if you say there aren't ghosts, there aren't all these things that clearly we have no evidence for, you're kind of making the world a more dry and uninteresting place. What about that issue?
I think that's a real risk, and I'd like to just again say I don't think skeptics go around saying there ain't no such thing as ghosts or psychics aren't real. Instead, and this is a nuanced point but worth making, we say we haven't yet found evidence to warrant belief in that claim. That's kind of a wordy way of saying I'm open-minded. If you can prove it, I'll believe it. But that's still different than saying there ain't no such thing as ghosts. I deny that silly belief. You know, I'm not going to be in my little club and talk with other skeptics about how smart I am and how dumb they are. Instead, I'm really trying to push this kind of open-minded skepticism.
DJ, do you still find an awe and beauty about sunrises?
Absolutely. And so the question really gets to does skepticism somehow
lessen the world?
Exactly. Does it diminish the beauty and wonder and awe of creation, or let's just say, you know,
existence
the brute facticity of our cosmos, our universe? I think the world is beautiful and life is beautiful, and, you know, we don't need to start wringing our hands in some existential way. But, you know, the skeptic, the scientist, can get every bit as much enjoyment and psychic, or let's say psychological, satisfaction about his or her experiences, and dare I say, even more than the person who denies this world, doesn't look at the real world, and instead is all wrapped up in stuff I would consider to be imaginary
DJ,
and kind of a distraction from the beauties of the real world.
DJ Grothy is the president of the James Randi Educational Foundation. If you've enjoyed this discussion, you'll enjoy the amazing meeting, which is happening later this month or next month.
It's July 8th
July
8th, 11th in Las Vegas.
In Las Vegas. You can find out more about the James Randi Educational Foundation and the amazing meeting and all about DJ Grothy and what he tries to do for the world on his website, randi.org. You can also get to that from geekspeak.org. DJ, thank you for joining us today on GeekSpeak.
Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Fun conversation.
Thanks. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by UC Santa Cruz, where biologist Barry Cenevo's pioneering research shows the impact of climate change on global biodiversity. This is UC Santa Cruz, online at ucse.edu. GeekSpeak is a registered service. Mark Valentine with David Lawrence and is used with permission.
And the USB, crazy USB of the week, is a USB greenhouse. It comes with marigold seeds, so I guess that's what you can grow in it. I don't think it'll work if you put watermelon seeds in it, since it's about the size of a softball. But I don't know. If you could grow something monstrous in it, like corn or an artichoke, I think that would be something. As far as the USB connection, it's fairly silly. It has a light, you install a program that has a calendar, lets you keep track of growth, but doesn't appear to do anything except beep to remind you to water it. So it only works in Windows, so if you need it to beep, you'll need Windows. For some reason, it needs drivers and 100 megabytes of drive space. I don't really get that. Anyway, it's a USB greenhouse. It's another crazy USB device. Check it out on geekspeak.org.
Thank you, Al. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP, Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. For GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. See you next week.